Beautiful Rubbish is my title this morning. The beautiful thing that Mary, this woman, did, and how it was perceived to be a waste. But what is waste? It's rubbish. It's something that's foolish. It's unprofitable, useless. But some people think this beautiful thing is rubbish. But Jesus sees it for exactly what it is. Look with me, if you will, please, in verse 6. Let's have a look at where we find Jesus. He has but 2 days before his arrest. And where do we see Jesus with so little time left, under such intense pressure? Where's Jesus? He's at Simon the leper's house. Isn't that Jesus? Isn't that Jesus? Of all the people in all the world that he's going to spend his last days and hours with, he goes to the house of somebody so unclean, so outcast, so rejected, so alone in the world. He finds the worst. He goes to the pits. He goes to find the suffering, the uncool, the unloved, the unlovely. And he says, that's where I'm going to be. That's Jesus. That's our Lord. That is our Saviour, spending his precious moments with people who are in the greatest of needs. Now, in John's Gospel, because you know that these events that we read of here are also recounted in some other passages, and in John, in chapter 12, and verse 1, we read that this house is described by other terms in John's Gospel. He doesn't call it Simon the leper's house. He says it's the house where Mary and Lazarus and Martha lived. So what we see from this is that this house, this leprous house, this house where nobody is allowed to go, this exclusion zone, has children that have grown up in this. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus have grown up in the house of Simon the leper. That's their home. Now that's a background for you, isn't it? Some people think they've been born on the wrong side of the tracks. These three have been born on the wrong side of the tracks, growing up in the house of a person who nobody wants to come near. Can you imagine the taunts they got at school in the street? People throwing little stones at them, saying, don't come near me, your daddy's Simon the leper. These three. This is a deeply troubled household. Can you see the implications in a society with no social security whatsoever? What it would be to be in a family with 3 children and your father is a leper? Is he going to get a job? What's he going to live on? How's he going to survive? With 3 children in his house and no mention of a mother. And you know what? Let's think about the children. Let's think about what's the effect of this on the children. I want you to think about Lazarus with me for a minute. You know, Jesus tells a very interesting parable. You'll be familiar with this parable, I'm sure. If you're Christians, you know your Bibles well. And in it, you will hear these words. There was a rich man. We hear about it in Luke's Gospel. He was dressed in purple. He had fine linen on. He lived in luxury every single day. At his gate was laid a beggar. This is interesting. I'm going to tell you the name of the beggar. You'll remember it, I'm sure, already. But it's interesting. There isn't one single parable of all the, I don't know how many parables there are in the New Testament, but of all the parables there are, not once is the name of the person mentioned. Here is the only exception. And the name of the beggar is Lazarus. And what was Lazarus's, the beggar's body, like in the story that Jesus tells? He had sores all over his body, we read. And he just longed to eat the food which fell from the rich man's table. Prepared to live like a dog, taking scraps from the table. Covered in sores, and then we read, even the dogs came and licked his sores. This is the poorest of the poor. This is the bottom of the pile. And his name was Lazarus. And interestingly, the character of Jesus' story, this Lazarus, this beggar, this sore-covered man, and of course exactly that's what leprosy is, and perhaps it wouldn't be entirely unreasonable to expect that, you know, if you grew up in the house of a leprous man, that you might indeed find yourself to be a leprous son, covered in sores, just like your father. That this man in the story, the Lazarus of the story, is sick and dies. And of course you and I know that the Lazarus, the son of Simon the leper, what happened to him? How they called for Jesus. Jesus, come, our brother is sick. And of course Lazarus dies. There is an undoubted parallel between the parable and the real life events. Am I reading too much? The difference is that in the story that Jesus tells, Lazarus dies and doesn't return. But the truth in the experience of Jesus' first visit to this household is that he went there to go and find the dead body of Lazarus. He had been dead 4 days. And Jesus stood at the mouth of that tomb and he cried out in a loud voice. He said, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus came to life. You see, Jesus goes into people's homes, he goes into people's lives, and he changes everything. He changed their lives. You know, John also tells us in his 12th chapter that the chief priest made a plan to kill Lazarus, as well as killing Jesus. Because so many of the Jewish people were being turned towards Jesus through his ministry. So here's a man who had been a beggar, possibly a leper, possibly the man who died, went to the bottom of the heap, and nobody cared for. But Jesus cared for him. Jesus gave him a new life and a new chance. And this man became the greatest advocate for Jesus in the area. So much so they decided to kill him. And this is the house that Jesus decides to go and visit. I want you to think about somebody else in the house, if you will. I want you to think about Mary, because we know that Mary was the brother, the sister of Lazarus. I'm going to court a little bit of controversy here. And the controversy is basically simply, if I can put it simply like this. There is a tradition of preaching that has existed for hundreds and hundreds of years that has been practiced by the Eastern Orthodox Church. And there's a tradition of preaching that's been practiced for hundreds and hundreds of years that's been supported by the Roman Catholic Church. And they don't agree. And the Eastern Orthodox Church says that Mary Magdalene and Mary, the sister of Lazarus and Martha, are two different people. But the Catholic tradition has maintained that they are one and the same person. And the Protestant tradition, which is only 300 or 400 years old, so it's hardly really had time for the concrete to set yet, is divided on the matter. I'm going to tell you what I think. Luke chapter 7, 36 to 50 reminds us that there was a meal that took place. It reminds us of the meal that we've just read about. And in the meal that we're told about in Luke, it took place many years before, a couple of years before the one we've been reading about just now. And at that meal, which was at a Pharisee's house, a very religious man's house, probably somewhere in the Judean hillside, which is where Bethany is in the Judean hillside, a sinful woman, that is a euphemism, isn't it, to suggest that she's probably a prostitute, had broken an alabaster jar of perfume over Jesus' feet. Do you remember the occasion? Do you remember the events? Then, as Luke tells us the account, he then, after the event, they leave the house together. This woman spills this perfume over Jesus' feet. And then the disciples with Jesus leave the house. And at the beginning of the next chapter, the first line of the next chapter tells us the 12 disciples were with Jesus. And also some of the women, we notice, who had been cured of evil spirits and diseases. And then we get the first name, Mary, called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had been cast out. And we see for the first time a woman mentioned as a follower of Jesus straight after the events of this woman, this prostitute, pouring out her perfume on Jesus' feet. John, before the meal that we've been talking about this morning, tells us that Mary was the sister of her brother Lazarus, who now lay sick. She, this is what John says, chapter 11, verse 2, she was the same one who poured the perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. And the people who believe that this is not the same person say, oh yes, but that's a reference to what she was going to do later on. But you can all knit your brows with me and can see this is completely inconceivable and illogical. So, what about this name, Magdalene? I'm making a point here because we want to build up a picture of this family and their conditions. Where does Jesus go? Who does Jesus go and spend time with? There's this name Magdalene that has to be resolved, because normally most expositors say, well, it's the name of a little town on Galilee called Magdala, and so it's the woman who came from Magdala. But you know, really, it comes from the root word Migdal, which means a tower. A high tower. High and mighty, upright Mary. I don't know, but I know this, that the Song of Solomon, in which there is a great deal about perfume, says of this beautiful woman, it writes, your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon looking out towards Damascus. And again, this word Migdal is used to describe slenderness, beauty, uprightness, fineness. And I find myself seeing a picture of a beautiful girl growing up in an entirely impoverished home with a sick brother, with no social opportunities whatsoever, and doing the one and only thing that presented to her as a way out. I think this Mary is the Mary that Jesus rescued from her situation. I think she's the one who became his devoted follower. And the third of the children, Martha, we read in Luke 10:41, Jesus speaking to her, Martha, Martha, and the Lord answered her, you are worried and upset about many things. Wouldn't you be worried and upset about many things, seeing your father disintegrating before your eyes, your brother begging in the streets, your sister prostituting herself? Just trying to keep the home together. Jesus goes to them. Those are the people in the forefront of his mind. You see, at the moment, Hillary Clinton has paid a visit to Haiti. But we know, don't we, that it's a symbolic visit. It's a political visit. It says something. But it's not the same as what Jesus does. He's not a politician who goes and sees the poor to add that to his portfolio of relevant sort of visits. Because we read that, in fact, that Jesus had already been staying the night of this meal for 4 or 5 days. That's where he resided. He didn't just pay them a visit, he lived with them. He lived with these people. He abides with them. He remains with them. And let me just point something else to you from another parable. This parable is the very famous parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan takes a journey. Do you remember where he goes from? He travels from Jerusalem to Jericho. Do you know there is only one town between Jerusalem and Jericho? Do you know what it is? There's only one place, one habitation between Jerusalem and Jericho. Do you know what it is? Bethany. Bethany. Just one place you can stop on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho. And in that place, wouldn't that be a respite? Isn't this home a place of refreshment and restoration and fellowship and encouragement and upbuilding in a world where the religious leaders reject you, the Levites and the priests are walking on the other side. When Jesus is besieged by opposition and hostility and indifference, somewhere where the outcasts, the pandexion, the inn where the Samaritan takes, where anybody's welcome, not just the prescribed holy temple where just the righteous of the righteous of the righteous of the righteous may abide, but the pandexion where anybody, the Jews, the Gentiles, the prostitutes, the thieves, anybody can go there, and there you can be built up and encouraged and fed. And is there some allusion to the home of Simon the leper as a place, an oasis of fellowship and nourishment and refreshment for whosoever, including Jesus, who is welcomed by such people, loved by such people? Remember the words of Jesus concerning the prostitute? He who is forgiven much loves much. And Jesus is so very wonderfully welcome amongst the outcasts and the broken and the poor and the soiled of this world. But a lot of the righteous really find themselves getting a little impatient. So, what I'm saying to you is this. This bottle of perfume we read about here in chapter 26 is not the first time that Mary has poured a bottle of perfume on Jesus' feet. She's doing it again. She does it when she first meets him. And she's doing it now when she's saying her goodbyes. She's taking as much as a half a litre of this stuff, do you understand? Half a litre of it. That's what it says in John. And it was this stuff called nard, spike nard, that she was pouring out. We read about that in John as well. Do you know where it comes from? There they are living in the Middle East in the first century AD. It came from the Himalayas. You know how far that is in the world of camels and asses? Do you know, can you imagine how expensive it would be to get perfumes from the Himalayas? Spikenard. We're told in John's Gospel this bottle was worth a man's wages, a year's wages for an agricultural worker. How much does a guy work working out in the fields? How much do you earn working in the fields for a year in this country today? I don't know, actually. 14,000, 15,000 people? Pounds, is that right? This bottle of spikenard, let's put a price on it. Maybe it's £15,000 worth of perfume. That's the sort of prices, you know, when you go to the NHS and you get your free shots because you've been paying your taxes. Some of those shots are £1,000 a shot, aren't they? You don't even feel all you feel is the needle. You don't get the bill because we just pay it through our taxes. This stuff, a half litre of this stuff, that's the kind of value. You know, they still use it today, this stuff, spikenard. And do you know what they use it for? For treating rashes, skin complaints, fungal infections of the skin, which is what leprosy is. And it also has a rather remarkable effect on the emotions as well. It eases deep-seated griefs. Kind of relaxes you a bit. It's like an antidepressant. It's used in the care of the dying to help them ease from life to death. And she's been buying this stuff in bulk, earning it from her lifestyle. This thick amber liquid, aromatic, relaxing, medicinal, to anoint her father's sick body, to try and help her brother, I don't know, make her customers feel comfortable, I don't know. But whatever it is, in the words of Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 12,
when the king is sitting at his table, I will make my spikenard send forth its fragrances. And she takes this stuff that she doesn't need for her father anymore. Because he's all right. Because of what Jesus has done. And she doesn't need it for her brother anymore. Because he's all right because of what Jesus has done. And she doesn't have to go into the streets anymore. Because it's all right because of what Jesus has done. And she just breaks the bottle and pours it on his feet. On the feet of the man who is about to die for them. Well, we could leave it there, couldn't we? But it has to be said that we have to look at what the disciples think of all this. The Christians. What do the Christians think about all this? Verse 8, verse 9. They said, this is a waste. What a waste. It says the disciples, that means all of them, all the disciples thought this was a waste. They didn't value it, they didn't appreciate it, they didn't understand it. They call themselves Christians. But they just did not get it at all. They want to turn it into money and give it out as gifts. It was the Passover, and if you give out lots of gifts during the Passover, everybody thinks you're wonderful. Curry political favour, let's get in with everybody we're supposed to be getting in with and fulfil our religious duties and all this sort of thing. Charity, blowing a trumpet before themselves. They want to be well thought of. And you know what? This is really sinister. In John chapter 12 verses 4 to 6 we realise that this kind of criticism of Jesus and criticism of this woman originates with one of the disciples in particular, it's Judas. It's Judas we read about. It says because behind the grumblings, he wanted to get his hands on that money because he held the purse, and if there was 300 denarius in his purse, he could put his little grubby fingers in there and take out a little bit for himself. See, charity for him was a profession. Isn't it terrible to see how disciples can turn so quickly against Jesus? How Christians can move away from him. One little thought, one word starting in one person's mind that develops. A little word here kind of goes around, and before you know it, you've got a mood and a gossip and a feeling amongst the group. And it's not of God. It's coming from hell. Somebody said, I've told you this before, that a fanatic is just somebody who loves God more than you do. Mary understood. Mary was in the moment. She was in the spirit. She was right there, wasn't she? She was so close to the Lord. Judas is there, sitting in the same room with Jesus, hearing all his teachings, seeing his wonderful things, but he has got his earplugs in and he's hardwired to the devil himself. Jesus is very categorical. What this woman has done is beautiful. And he establishes what I'm doing today. He has ordered that I should preach here in North Bradley this message. That you should be reminded again about this beautiful thing that Mary did. Right? That's commissioned there. Wherever the gospel is preached. That's what he said. And so it's upon me to be obedient to that message, reaching back nearly 2,000 years, that everywhere we go, we Christians go, we are going to tell people that what she did was beautiful, and it is beautiful. And if you're so moved to give up all the stuff that you had, that you don't need anymore, because God has freed you by the wonderful things that Jesus has done, and you decide to lavish it all on him, that's beautiful too. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. Because it's approved of God.
Isn't it interesting in verse 14? This is where Judas makes his decision. It's this event that turns him. And this is when he scurries off. Because I'm thinking about this, that Judas at this point begins to realize that Jesus really is going to be crucified. This is not just talk. This is not posturing. He really is about to die. And he's been following this guy. He's been following him around for 2 or 3 years. And he's been eking out his little existence on the back of Jesus. And Jesus is about to go. And he's not going to have anybody to protect him anymore. And he wants to be on the winning side. He doesn't want to hang around with Jesus because Jesus is a loser, isn't he? Because Jesus hangs around with losers. He's not a winner. Jesus goes to the cross and suffers and dies a horrible public execution, is humiliated before all people. And he goes and stays, where's his grand hotel? Does he go and stay at the Ritz? He goes and stays at Simon the leper's house with a prostitute and the lepers. He starts to think for himself, man, I've got to get out of here, you know? It's getting too hot. I'm not going to survive. I'm not going to make it. I need a new ruler, I need a new lord, I need somebody else who's going to protect me and take care of me and I can take my little piece out of. It's all just a big game in his head. But he's missed the point, isn't it? You see, because Christianity, religion, if it means anything at all, you see, we have to ask ourselves, why are we here at church? Why are we believers? Why are we calling ourselves Christians? Why do we read our Bibles and pray? Why do we trust Jesus? Who are we in this for? Are you in it for yourself? Is it what you can get out of this? Is that the deal? Because Jesus was in it for what he could give. And that Judas didn't understand. And that's what we have to understand. We're here to see what we can give, how much we can give, what can we give here. That's why we're here. Well, he's off, and he gets paid 30 pence a day's wages compared to £14,000 in just one moment sprinkled. You know, I told you, no, in my conversion, I met this tramp. He was practically deranged, this man. He practically lost his mind. But he did know and trust the Lord Jesus Christ. You don't have to be smart. You don't even have to be sane to trust Jesus, right? This man, I don't know what happened in his life, but I just remember him standing there talking to me, just saying, you know, the world could pay me $100 billion, trillion, and he was rabbiting on like this, you know, but it would never be more than what Jesus gives me. You know, because Jesus loved him. He knew that. In the fog of his mind, his confusion, he understood that. You don't need an A-level to be a Christian. You know, the world offers us many, many things. Let me conclude. Here are my final reflections I want to leave you with. I've told you that this passage makes me think about why we're in this. What are we doing this for? It also makes me wonder, what can I give? It makes me think that charity, if it's done properly, if it comes from the right heart and the right attitude, Jesus was profoundly charitable to come amongst these people, wasn't he? He's so powerful. But too often it's been corrupted and it's lost its. Makes me think about the humble, the broken, the outcast people who the Lord so wonderfully befriends and helps. And I think how he's helped me. And I have to classify myself amongst those people to enjoy that and accept that fact. And so do we. So do we all. It makes me think the love of money is a big, big, big mistake. You know, money's a necessity. Fine. The love of money is a disaster. It makes me think that hospitality, true Christian hospitality, Christ at the center, is wonderful.
And I would that this church was like, I wish I could get a brush and some paint and go out the front of the church and paint the house of Simon the leper. Everyone welcome. Jesus, please come visit. And it makes me suspicious of the motives of people who kind of have a very reasonable, rational, spiritual sounding excuse for not being like that. I'm going to leave you with all that and your thoughts and your prayers, because we have an opportunity to eat at the Lord's table. And that's what Mary did, didn't she? He was eating at the table. She came to the table and she worshipped him. This is our opportunity to come and worship the Lord together, isn't it? That's why we're here. And we need to ask ourselves, this Christian life, is it for you? Is it for me? Is it still for me? I know it used to be, but is it still? Am I still walking with him? Do I still feel the same way? Have I got any jars of alabaster that I ought to get out of the cupboard and pour on his feet?